keep going.
Are you on Twitter or X?
I am on Twitter, but I have changed my name and done a few things over time, and I've got like one follower.
I think I'm going to get on it. It takes a while for me to learn a platform, but now I want to get on it because
since you read Elon Musk's story,
mostly because my brother is always like, I've heard multiple times that you can learn things about what's going on in the world before it hits the news on Twitter, and I want to know exactly what that means.
Oh yeah, for sure. You know how.
Can you actually do it, or is everybody on Twitter just living in some vortex of a feedback loop?
You probably don't go deep enough into Let's Run on their forum to know this,
mm-hmm.
but anything you want to know in the real world that's going on shows up on that forum well before, like before it hits.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have to, there's a lot of shit that goes on there that gets up posted up there that never happens, but almost always some big, huge revelation or thing that comes up there first. And Twitter may be the same version of that. And
I guess it's called X. It's weird to call it Twitter when
it's called X. We should call it X, but
it's fascinating.
Yeah. Although, do they still call them tweets?
I don't know what
when
they
you
call
send
them.
Something at yeah. the X's. I don't know. It, that forum has always, you know, I've always been much more interested in the artistic element that's availed with Instagram. Yeah. Even though I'm a big writer, thinker, and pontificator with some pretty quippy quotes I could throw onto Twitter, which is like really aligned with my way of being and doing work. I got hooked onto Instagram because I love photography so much. And so having that element of creativity layered with the ability to pontificate or share a story or whatever else has always kept me in the IG world rather than the Twitter / Facebook world. Though now my daughter and wife are telling me that I am so far behind because I'm not on TikTok. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, Lena's on TikTok.
Yeah, they all are. The whole world is on
it's
TikTok. Yeah.
That's just it makes me like wanna. It's just too quick.
I think, man. I would go, even though I think Twitter is, oh, sorry, X is a little bit more intellectual /
it almost feels
big
a little
thinkers.
Too political though.
It does,
it
and it seems a little too
political.
A little too adult. I love
too,
that TikTok
yeah.
has the kid element, like the youthful vibrant vibe,
uh-huh.
but good stuff's going on there. I haven't even actually downloaded the Twitter app to my phone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sorry, the TikTok app to my phone, because I'm so worried that I will get sucked in. Totally sucked in.
Yeah.
But
yeah. No,
I'm interested to see how your experiment goes. If you want to follow me, I'm Run Gnosis on there. You can type my name in or Run Gnosis. But I don't go on there. I mean, I never go on there. So nothing happens. I check it every once in a while. I have, I think I even turn notifications off so I don't even get anything. But anyway.
I got it. I'm going to follow you.
Yeah,
let's
gonna,
see what's happening
not
here.
Not much is going to happen. But
you're one of my, let's see.
70, you're following 70? Remember,
you're four followers.
So I will.
No, I'm following four people.
So
we
I will
somehow have 411 followers.
Yes, because you see, that's crazy. Like that's how it works. So you're going to be under Atreyu, not under Michael, right?
I think so.
I think that's a good way to go. As long as you put your name, make sure your name is showing up somewhere where someone can see it when you post or if they go to your profile. Do you know what I mean? You want to make sure you have a personal, like I'm under Steve Sisson, but my X handle is Run Gnosis because I was working on that project for a while. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You should not be getting advice about how to manage your socials from Steve Sisson.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I just want to. I don't.
But all our listeners should follow Atreyu at the X for hot takes by Michael.
Oh yeah, I thought it was all. Yeah, I miss Instagram back in how it used to be.
Yeah,
now it's like a lot of. It just seems like a lot more ads, and everybody I follow in the sports world is always trying to be an ambassador of something. So it's like. It's just a bunch of people selling other people's products. It's very odd, Instagram, but there is so many good, it's so easy for me to understand And through all of that, like for every three weird posts, there's like always one good one.
Yeah. I like the what I go to Instagram for are basically three things. People I really care about and follow, but mostly I'm on their stories because stories are a little more vibrant.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Movers, shakers, idea makers that I follow that still use that platform. And then this, what I call the ridiculous, which for me are Rushed, Street Art Globe.
Mm-hmm.
These are purely like art / prank / fast bike.
I like that.
Fast car doing crazy stuff, chases and like things like that. Motorcyclists getting jumped up over. It's half Jackass, half fast, half what is it? Fury Racing, Fury or whatever. I don't know. Vin Diesel shows. There's a sort of vibe there, that like entertainment that's going on. And Kristen tells me that though the place to go for all that stuff is TikTok. That's where the real.
But aren't they saying it's going to get shut down?
I mean, I don't know. There'll be a lot of sad people. Something will pop right back up because so many people use it.
Yeah.
I mean, Kristen and Max spend about 20 minutes, you know, once a week, twice a week, where they just sit down on the couch pre getting ready for bed and everything else when the last blue light, you know, last moments of blue light are allowed in Max's life.
Yeah, for sure.
And they snuggle and watch TikTok videos. And I'm a little jealous because they're having this incredible, and it's a mix of animal things. That's another thing I follow, are German short hair pointer Jackass stuff, that because I have a German short hair pointer, so they do all these crazy stupid things, and so I end up getting a lot of those in my feed. Anyway, we should probably cut all this out of the episode.
Yeah, no, it's
sorry.
Social media we live in an interesting time, man.
May you live in interesting times, as the Chinese adage goes.
Boy, I had a weird thought this morning. You want to hear it?
Yes, I would love to hear it.
I've never sat there and thought deeply about the world after I'm not in it. Have you thought about that?
No.
Check this thought out. All right. So here's the weirdness of this thought. I imagine many, many scenarios. What's going to happen when I'm old? What was going on when I was young? I was thinking about myself in like sixth grade, you know, in fifth grade. And I was like, man, it's weird how I can put myself back into that kind of, you know, imagine yourself like after school going for a bike ride. Doing
Is it
all
a feeling
things.
State? Is
kind
it a memory
of,
state?
Like it was more like feeling skate? Like, damn, I should have enjoyed it more. Like I was thinking specifically on this one thought, how I ended up to that weird thought that I shared, but it was like I used to think that school was a really long period of time. And like each day was like a long day. I was like, man, it's just not that long. It's like you make it to lunch, then you got like three more hours and you wrap it up and then you go home and then you just try and it's like just trying to put myself in that. I was like, that was cool. Like, it was really cool. Being a kid was cool, but it was weird how I could like tap back into that like really readily. And then I started thinking, one day when I'm, you know, not in this body or whatever happens, I was like, this is going to be weird, because then you could think like 100 years after that, the world will still like, it'll still look like this outside more or less. There are things happening.
I'm not sure, but anyway.
Right, though?
Yeah. I mean, it's likely that there will be these trees out there. There's likely that this building will still exist, whether or not people are inhabiting it or not inhabiting it.
But it's just weird to think, like, you know, 1,000 years ago, it just got weird. Like, like my state of mind today was very weird. I was like, well, maybe I was walking around in something else. But, like, you know what I mean? So I didn't want to get too deep into, like, the metaphysical or, like, the religious aspects or anything like that. But I was like, just, all right, face value, here are the cards. I'm in this life. If I'm not in this life and we're like 100, 200 years into the future, it's weird to think that like it just keeps moving forward. Things just keep going. It's like, whoa, there's so much before and after.
You know, and our relative importance is extremely low.
That's what I was also kind of thinking too.
The hubris that we have in this lifetime.
You think your problems are really big, but then like think just 150 years into the future when probably there's a whole other crop, you know, into the mix. It's so funny.
And there will be a few historical figures that people will remember. You know, I think they'll remember Elon. They'll remember Trump.
He'll be written in.
I mean,
that dude will be in the books.
They'll remember a few people, you know, they'll remember some scientists who we don't know now who are Nobel Prize winners, whose technology or innovations or scientific discoveries we're really not even really ready. You know, whatever direction AI goes will be very interesting to see. But it's unlikely that Steve Sisson and Michael Krajicek are going to be warrant even a footnote anywhere in the context of the world.
Yeah,
of all things.
Which means my problems aren't as big as they seem.
Correct. Yeah. And then you should love who you love and live what you want to live because...
It was just a weird thought. It was like,
really cool.
We always think in terms of start and end, but it's like, no.
That's so cool.
There's so much more after this. And it was weird, you know, just to kind of, I rarely try and tap into that emotion, like trying to identify that one and be like, what about 400 years from now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's going on is what you're thinking about right now, even worth your anxiety or your stress. And it's like, good point.
Yeah, it is though, because it's here, because that's just an idea. That's just a concept.
Shit.
You find yourself right here, right now.
Shit.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've been living my days a little bit better, though. It's all part of the journey, man.
Speaking of making a mark, that's our topic this week.
Yeah.
This week, you came up with a couple of really interesting ideas, but then I threw a haymaker at you and said, if we don't get to talking about your prep for your Ironman coming up in Galveston in a couple of weeks, we're going to miss the opportunity to really explore what we opened up a year ago, or I guess it was about 9 months ago, talking about your base training, and you went through that whole phase where...
When did I even start?
I think it was in June.
Remember.
I think it was in June when we first cut our first episode around, because John wasn't with us. John had left already. So it was really early on when it was just a duo instead of a trio.
Mm-hmm.
But... You know, I'm curious.
And I was just getting into it all.
Yeah, and you were a little nervous about how far out you were making a plan for, but you felt like really inspired.
So, about 10 months, 9 months or so.
You felt inspired to try a longer approach, spend some time in the zone 2 working on, you know, we did a whole episode on Maffetone where we kind of talked through that stuff because that's kind of the mode you were in. So I'd like to just unpack how training has proceeded. You don't need to go in a, you know, a session by session review, but more like the big picture now as you're trying to assess and plan. And many athletes that are going to hear this episode, they're getting ready for Boston or London or Rotterdam or Eugene or a large number of races, or they're in triathlon world. Some of our listeners are triathletes. And it is interesting, I think, in every case to hear an individual person's experience in terms of their training cycle, what they're thinking through, but especially so when we've already unpacked some stuff early on. We had a mid-season loose discussion, was 15, 20 minutes in one episode that we did. But more important, I think it's going to be really valuable to hear people hearing now how someone who has had rather nebulous, open, you've had a very open training cycle in which you followed a particular plan in your swimming from an expert, but generally you created your own self-coached plan with your running and your cycling.
Mm-hmm.
But yet now you've got to assess fitness, assess how to approach the race, how to think about what your goal will be, what your strategies are. And I went on a run with you yesterday and we were talking about that just a little bit. And I just thought, oh God, this is a great topic.
Yeah.
This is something we need to address before the moment slips away. And then we lose the thread and it just becomes, oh, how did your race go? And then we talk about it for 10 minutes and that's it. I just think it warrants our listeners' attention, my attention, on top of the fact that I'm just really fucking curious.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a nice one because, you know, I'm going to try and parlay it to some universal ideas because I would prefer
to get into the
myopic nature of it, you know, like the training, which is just, it's just so fundamental and kind of basic, but I went into the whole idea was really, really hip on Maffetone base, building a base for a long time. And I had that goal to, I think I had like maybe get up to 15 miles, you know, on the weekend, 15, 16 on the weekend. This by January 1st, my goal, like I had like a milestone, like base is done on January 1st. And this was the goal going into it. So like through the summer, the fall.
You ran a half. No, you did a half Ironman.
I don't even remember. Did I do one? Yeah, I did one in Waco. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I had this goal to like complete, you know, a 5-hour, close to 100-mile ride, and I envisioned it going a lot different than how it ended up, to be honest with you. And I think I learned some things that I didn't expect. I thought I was going to get past a base phase and into something very, very kind of structured and articulate. And, you know, in the months, the 4 months, January, February, March, April. Yeah, 4 months leading up to the race, including like, these are going to be structured speed work days. These are going to be perfect, you know, mileage, like mapped out each week. And what happened was something that I didn't quite expect, which was once the base was built, the training methodology became more of a, we also were talking a lot about the nervous system coming around to the turn of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that the most work I probably needed to do was not get into a feedback loop of trying to go too hard and put those speed work sessions in and really like kind of like try and grind the body too much. So it was really interesting because it's a subtle point, but I guess what I'm trying to say is the intention took a different flavor, and the intention was not just to hit race time marks. The intention was to try and approach each training session with a lot of joy. And then there was like one session where I was like, I didn't like a swim, and you came back and you were like, but aren't you trying to do that? I was like, oh yeah, I forgot. That was a tough swim, and it wasn't a fail. It was more about like, so I realized like I needed to do more work on trying to enjoy the sessions.
How easy it is to fall into the numbers game.
Yes, yes.
And start checking the numbers boxes off.
Right. And so the past, you know, 3 months or so have been pretty exceptional, to be honest. I mean, I think from the base phase, I figured there would be like an elevation phase, like where you go up and then you find the plateau and then you peak and then you race. But really it's just been more of a continuum of the base phase and honing in on kind of perceived, not even perceived effort. I think it's more like a perceived, perceived perception where it's like being able to really identify what the race requires. And so to me, that's been the big idea is, what does the race require? And it's going to be, you know, in terms of a long distance triathlon, like an Ironman, it's a lot of volume. It's a lot of, you know, sustained efforts. And it's been very, very, very kind of odd because I'm happier than I've ever been. I've trained longer than I've ever trained. And now it's time to make a race intention. And I think I have one, but it has less to do with time. The time is there. Like I'm going to shoot for around 10 hours flat, which would be a 30-minute PR. And that would be like a super stretch goal. But what's weird about it is that I'm not even focused on the time. I'm focused on, am I prepared to feel the way that I know that I'm going to feel? And at one certain point, like I'm going to have to decide 75% of the way through the race, like, did I set myself up for the last 25%?
Right.
And how's that going to feel? And and I'm more trying to mentally play that out. If I blow up and I have to walk, am I gonna do it with a good attitude or a bad attitude? So putting a lot of thought into how I'm gonna react when that happens, and how I'm gonna react if I'm like gonna go into that last 13 miles of the race running, knowing that, you know, like, am I going to have what it takes to run that 13 to the goal, and what that's going to feel like? So a lot of it has to do with me now mentally being prepared emotionally to, if there is a blow up, that it's, that I do it with a little bit of grace, you know, and it's not just going to be a failure. It's going to be something that I can celebrate. Because I really do think that I've put in something. I'm going into this race completely different than I've ever gone into anything.
Yeah, it's hard to do that.
Yeah, agreed.
And you're a little lost. And I don't mean lost in the sense of terrible, like that's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things here, I think the term you were looking for when you said perception of perception is predicting the perceived experience you'll have on race day. So much of what you've been doing in training is trying to predict, to set a session out, to give you kinds of experiences that you feel like you will get into on race day that will allow you to have this positive feedback loop, regardless of what happens.
Yeah.
So that's like, I call that perception of experience, or predictive perception, like predicting what that'll be. This is what my entire program that I created, Telos, is all about. I have set sessions that are designed to give people the ability to be effective at predicting, to be effective at dealing well with their experience, and making sure their perception of that experience stays in the zone that's most advantageous to the result that they're trying to gain. In some cases, that's stretching and really kind of pushing and going hard, in which they're going to feel really bad, and they're going to have to then be prepared for that. So, you know, we have one final session for my folks to in Boston this weekend. And one of the things I said to one of the athletes that's sort of on the fence, do I want to go for it, or I'll get a PR regardless. So do I just enjoy that experience, or do I press for something else? And I'm like, well, you've got one more last session to kind of test that. So be aggressive, right? Be aggressive in the session to test whether that aggressiveness is something you're going to want to take on race day. But your event is so challenging because you've got the three components.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to go on the bike. I mean, just swim's going to be the swim, from what I understand. All you've done is just try to get yourself as fit as fuck so you can swim the best you can. And you're not really going to be like moderating effort on the swim. You're just going to get in the water and do the thing to the best of your ability, get out of the pool, get on the bike and spend a few minutes recovering, and then getting into whatever you think you have to do. And how are you going to
getting on the bike is like the first time you ever in a race get to even think about what you're going to do.
Correct.
During the race.
Everything,
so you're like 2 hours in,
everything's instinctual,
and then you start to really map out your race. So it's like the same with your athlete going to Boston. Where my mind's at is, what's the difference between going for it or not going for it? There is no difference unless you place a certain value that one is better than the other.
Correct.
And then if you haven't explored those two routes and know the kind of like the
cost.
Yeah, the cost, the cost of, benefit, of those two
the
things.
The cost and benefit.
Which
of
I think is, now it's easy practically, you know, these hotel rooms in the Woodlands are like anywhere from like $300 to like $700, because these races, they max out. Same in Boston. Mm-hmm. Very expensive.
So this is Woodlands, not a Galveston.
This one's at Woodlands. The Galveston is, they have a 70.3.
Oh, okay.
This weekend, and they're always a month apart, and a lot of people do both.
Oh, because they're trying to prep. It's a halfway and then they're full.
Yeah, so the one in the Woodlands is later in the month. And so just like Boston, I mean, we're spending, you know, the race entry plus the hotel plus the travel. Often it's anywhere between $1,000 and $3,000 to go to these damn races, like depending on, especially Boston. It's very expensive.
Very expensive.
And so you've got money on the line. You've got time on the line. You got time spent training. And for somebody like me, the main thing is to not place all the chips on the race, even though it is the A race.
It's on the outcome.
Exactly.
On the outcome.
Exactly.
You're basing it all on the race because you wouldn't go out there otherwise.
Exactly.
But I think that's really important to highlight to folks, because I think that a lot of times they think this idea, this is the challenge you have. How do you deselect outcome but still keep the selection of the best race you can possibly run in the game? As available.
Right. And all the workouts and all the time and all the investments we've put into those months prior, it's you really, to me, when you boil it down, you have two choices. One is to see those sessions as an escrow payment on what you're going to withdraw at the race, and you're owed that race. That race needs to give you something. It owes me something. Or you can put it into an investment and withdraw an experience. And the experience doesn't necessarily have to pay you back. It doesn't have, you don't have to get all your money back. You know,
well,
you might not
does.
Get all your money back from
it
from,
does give you all your money back for sure. It just
from the experience.
You just may
you pay
not
for
have
a vacation. You just might have a weird trip.
Correct.
So
it's just like a vacation anyway. Right?
What I realized is that in the previous years, my sessions, the intention of the session was the intention on getting paid back in full exactly right. how I wanted it paid
Correct.
Back.
As it was on your spreadsheet.
And I see so many people
yes,
feeling like they need to get paid back exactly what they put in. And if not, the coach is wrong, the training was wrong, I was wrong, doing all the stuff. And I've had to, as I've come like very clear-minded about this race, I've realized that the most work I've needed to do is to eliminate that thought and work towards eliminating that thought. It was a process. It's taken a lot of work. And so instead of this build, you know, that January 1st build, when I was like, let's turn it on, you're fit, let's turn it on, it's the mindset that's been different. And that's where, like, kind of keying in to getting a very, very healthier, a more healthy outlook on what the experience will deliver has been really eye-opening. And I would recommend it to anybody. And if you're anything like me and you expect the race to give you something back exactly how you want it back, I don't think that's why the race exists. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, I mean, then there's the other side of that, which is This is going to be a lot of fun because, you know, I'm kind of in uncharted territory. I've never been, you know, mentally this, like this going into a race. So,
and you're fit.
Yeah, very, very, feeling very fit. You know, I haven't done a lot of the, I envision myself doing, like I said on the run, I envision myself doing more calculated speed work, but through the schedule that I've made, which has been pretty large. I mean, Monday is a 7-mile run and an hour and a half bike. Tuesday is a 4,000-meter swim and an hour and a half bike, or an hour session with 30 minutes of hard intervals. Wednesday is a 10-mile run and a gym session. Thursday is a 4,000-meter swim and you know, like an easy bike or kind of a full recovery after that. And then Friday is, you know, a 7-mile run, getting ready for the weekend into a 5-hour ride, 3-hour run on Saturday, and then a 15 to 20-mile run on the Sunday. So it's packed. It's packed, packed, packed. And so what I've discovered was it was easier for me not to implement a true speed session, because what I needed was the pull time.
Mm-hmm.
And the days that I would have gotten my speed session were the 2 days in the pool that I really needed to optimize.
And I got to see you once a week after your Thursday session.
Yeah.
And the idea of doing some kind of high quality speed session, like, you would have been exhausted. Like, you put a lot of...
That would have gone into the Fritz land.
It would have,
you know,
set you up for overtraining.
I think so.
Yeah, especially with the way that the master's program that you're in is a well, it's designed for primarily for master swimmers, but it is heavily used by triathletes.
Yeah, but very much so.
And it's targeted to allow you to get everything out of it. But just like my program is good for triathletes, it's not targeted for triathletes.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, your coach was giving you 4K in the pool to prepare you to be the best swimmer you could be, regardless of where you did, not necessarily to be thinking about globally over the entire load that you're carrying for a given week and keeping all those things balanced in a way to help you succeed. However, let's go back and think about this. One of the things I think is so intriguing about the Ironman distance specifically when mm-hmm. we come to the run is it's irrelevant what doing any pace work. The only reason that pace could help you would be to help you with economy, so your biomechanics, but you're already really good with biomechanics. You've got a good, smooth, rhythmic biomechanics. And so what you're really doing is searching for that day, the right rhythm for that
day. To me, it's a rhythm.
Yeah.
There's been so much getting in touch with the rhythm. It's a weird situation because now all of the runs, you know, I've always envisioned like, man, if my goal pace for the marathon could be like 7 minutes and 30 seconds a mile, that would be cruising. I would be like on fire. My half marathon time is like 6:55, mm-hmm. 6:52 in the last one. But I was like, man, 7:30 would be great. So instead of getting speed work on the top end to kind of neutralize that, what I've done is a lot of volume at 8 minutes and closing in on 7:30s and really focusing on how I feel towards the end of a 15-mile run to close out 4 miles at like 7:15, just to be like, this is only a run and it's only 18 miles. So how are you going to feel after a 112-mile bike and an hour swim? You know, so it's weird to kind of...
Because you cannot prep for that.
You can't, not in one day.
No.
You see what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's the rhythm that has really been nice. You know, this, if you're doing 40 to 50 miles of running a week and 8 minutes feels easy, then that rhythm can become, you can hang your hat on that, getting off the bike and being like, this is how I run. That, you know, that's just my rhythm. So if I'm racing, anytime I even feel like I'm doing work, 7:30 or under, it's like, okay, here we go. So it's been kind of a super meditation on what you all often say, which is, what does the race require? And sessions are no longer sessions. They're always kind of pointing towards, what does the race require? And I've been trying to back into that idea over and over and over again. And if you're, again, like if you're anything like me, that's also hard to do. So the two big points that I think I can make coming into this part of the going into the race, creating a race intention, has been understanding that training should point to what does the race require.
And in the case of a marathoner who has a specific goal time that they'd like to mm-hmm. achieve, the need for them to spend a bit more time working on a variety of paces and then also working on specific race pace is, regardless, even if their intention is to find the right rhythm, it's good to do a wide variety of different pace work to get economical at it, to get efficient at it, to have a better understanding of the felt sense, the felt experience of those things. So that when you run, if you're trying to go under, you know, 3 hours for a marathon, that when you run 6:50 per mile, that feels like an appropriate rhythm. And you do some time at 6:50, but you don't spend too much time on running 6:50 because, especially at a race like Boston, you're not going to be able to run 6:50. You're going to have to run 6:45 and 6:55 and 6:32 and 7:03 as you're going up the hill. So
doing tempo work, 10K work and everything can help you back into your pace.
Correct.
And make it feel way more natural when you back into the pace, when you settle into the rhythm. And so that's where all of the sessions, whether they be power sessions on the bike and everything, is when I'm thinking, when I'm doing my intervals, is you're not going to have to race this hard.
Right.
just do the intervals because you're not going to have to race this hard.
Correct. But you are going to have a new accumulated load in the race that will be higher than the load you've accumulated by the time you're at. So maybe going at those faster paces is appropriate for the feeling state that you'll have on race day, although it will be unique. It's really interesting. You know, I was this made me think of something I haven't thought of in a very long time. My collegiate coach, I disagreed with so much of what he had us do for, you know, a long time until I think until I became a pro coach. And even as I was a collegiate coach, I still didn't really understand what he was doing. But now it's like how I base everything. He used to make us work on rhythm running all the time, and he called it that, running in a rhythm. And he'd make us run these strange workouts where we'd started from campus, UT's campus, run 2.5 miles up to the intramural fields. Then we would do 2 miles or 3 times a mile on this loop, this grass loop. And he would not tell us what pace to run. He said, I just want you to get into a rhythm. And I was always angry at him. You know, I was like, well, what is that pace? You know, and now I'm talking with my athletes who are like angry at me because I'm like, don't just do it on steady. It was basically steady.
Sure.
But his thing that he would say to us all the time was it's not he wouldn't use the word steady. He used the word rhythm because he was trying to encourage in us the felt experience of what a rhythm feels like. And anybody that's been in rhythm for a hard period of time, whether that's, you know, 10 minutes or 60 minutes or, you know, in your case, 3+ hours, where you're tired and exhausted and worn out, but you know the appropriate rhythm to give you a chance to stay in the arena, to stay available, to get the outcome you'd like to. You know, the rhythm is important, but it's not the all-encompassing must-have. And, you know, when my coach would have us do that session, then we would run off and do another, we would run off to another location, do these hill circuits, and we'd go back to the track and do some track workout. And he stressed that session. I mean, we did it every 2 weeks through all of the cross-country season, and then a good bit of the time into the track season, and then we would just pivot off of it late. But what he was doing there is giving us this feeling state, and then he would throw in at us occasionally race type experiences. So he would have somebody
after the rhythm,
no, in the rhythm, in the rhythm, or at other different. He would have key people who were the fartlek element that they would throw down, or you might come up to you beforehand and be like, "Steve, I want you to push when you get to the halfway point and try to run away from people," but he wouldn't tell anybody else. He would just tell me.
Oh, that's awesome.
Or he would do it, or he would do it to another athlete, and you were pretty sure. And sometimes he wouldn't do it to anybody, so you never knew. But as soon as somebody's tail feathers started like lining up, and they started picking the pace up, you were like, "All right, this is coach's throw. He's making us get out of rhythm, but we have to stay in rhythm because you couldn't sustain the whole session if you just chased after the guy." So it taught us really well how to do this. And I'm just realizing now in this conversation,
it's not a rhythm if you're huffing and puffing trying to keep up with the guy.
Correct. But if you let him go, race over.
Yeah.
You got to be in it to win it. That's something I've always said. It's like, you got to be in it to win it. Sure. So if you let him go, but that's what you're doing in your race at the Ironman. It's like, sometimes you got to let it go and hope it'll come back. Or you can follow that rhythm and go with it. But it's like, rhythm running is in a really important aspect that's hardly ever talked about. That's important for trying to reach goal times, but it's also really important in terms of competing against people, is this idea that your rhythm is your rhythm, and you have to negotiate with that appropriately to get the outcome that you're looking for. And that by itself is purely process. So yes, you're still targeting this outcome that you'd like to get, sub-3 Boston, or in your case, you'd like to get somewhere between 10 hours and a half. And you're going to be relatively happy with all of that, but you're going to play that by ear as the race goes and unfolds, because that's what races are all about.
You know, it's fascinating too, because I've decided that this is probably going to be, I don't like saying the last of anything, but like I'd actually be surprised if I signed up for another Ironman after this one. But that being, and I think I've made that conclusion just because I've realized what the race requires in terms of the race distance and the training and the load and everything that I've had to put through. It's a lot of times, like at least 20 hours of work a week. And it's fascinating. And that's if you want to operate like a professional would set themselves up to operate. And to what's fascinating to me is that I asked you a few weeks ago, like, how do these professionals get to race one of these a month, like in a season? It's crazy. And it's because they're not just gambling one race. They're finding their rhythm through all of the races. And that's what's super interesting is, like, I can imagine a world where I didn't decide to kind of like stop doing Ironman racing. And if I were to continue, I can see a clear formula to getting better. Mm-hmm. And it's through experience and finding that rhythm through the races. And each race, it is a gamble. Like, and knowing that it is a gamble is, it's so real. The marathon gamble is so real. You know, you could probably, if you really wanted to get a great marathon done, I would imagine doing like 3 in a year and building up an entire year for those 3 races. You know what I'm saying?
And you plan them out, so the final one is your command performance, but you're hopeful that maybe one of them will turn into something amazing.
Something amazing.
And then you don't even need to do the third one.
Even better if you do the same thing in the next year.
Correct.
And so if you keep stringing that together, then basically the experience is on your side, and the perfect conditions and the perfect day and all that shit is on your side.
Because there's more chances, yes.
Yeah. So, and again, it comes back to the culture of the non-pro athlete who places all their chips on these races and has that mental disposition about the race. And it's kind of like, it's, you know, it's an all or nothing. I have to do this for, you know, I'm not. And it's like, it's,
and the elites and the pros aren't even doing that.
No, they're not at all. I mean, they know that they go into a race being like, it's kind of like a flip a coin. It's either my day or it's not my day.
And they're ready to go, but they don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
They're ready to go, but they don't know. And I think this is also something, you know, one of the things you and I have talked about, I don't know that we've talked about it on air yet, but mm-hmm. You had with the Ironman, you did have this idea in your head for a very long time that you really wanted to get to Kona. And that has been the driver to keep you engaged in the triathlon and in the Ironman distance, especially throughout periods of profound dislike of the event, of the training, of other things. And I think you have sort of deselected again that objective, which then gives you the chance to kind of step back from this particular performance and have a more open feel for it. And if crazy things happen and you end up in the top 5, then there you go, but probably not likely. And so therefore, you don't have as much of a drive for the event itself to be the final arbiter of success or failure, but it also provides, which is critical and crucial to the mindset that you have. But I wonder if you could have that mindset if you were thinking about it from the standpoint of
have to get to Kona.
Well,
you could directly replace it with gotta run Boston,
right?
You could also directly replace it with have to qualify for New York City, which is even more aggressive than Boston.
Correct.
If you don't live in the state of New York.
Correct.
And it begs the question, like,
but none of these are as hard as Ironman.
it's become particularly tough.
Yes,
and,
to get to Kona.
And yeah. I think a lot of it had to do with calling it like it is. Like, it's an incredibly competitive field. It's in this realization that to create the outcome that you want, or the outcome that I want in the command performance race continuum, whether it be this race or the string of races after it, shooting for that goal, I've realized for this distance, for what this race distance requires a mindset to excel at it that I simply don't know if I have. It's not about getting to the race. Even the race is not about getting to the race. It's about being the best. Mm. In your field, mm-hmm. in your age group. And then even then it's a little bit of chance too, because they don't always have, it's not always the top 3 mm-hmm. get to go. Mm-hmm. So there's something, I used to think it was a very linear goal. Do well in the race, just go get top three and you'll go to Kona. And it's just not, doesn't seem like, what I've realized is that the folks who get to Kona typically have gone a few times. They are what you would say the general practitioners of excellence in the race distance, which means that they are the ones stringing races together.
And they're well seasoned.
They're well seasoned. Exactly. This is something that they just didn't decide that they were going to do. It's something that they do.
Correct.
It's like the goal isn't what they're going to do. It's the race that they're doing.
And that's
over
not,
and over. It's a mindset.
And
it's
a lifestyle. And that's not a lifestyle. You're realizing now that lifestyle is not a lifestyle I'm interested in the long haul.
Right, right. Yeah, it's because there's, you know, it's, I was interested in, I was always being like, I could probably do this for about 3 or 5 years and like kind of get there. But even that mindset, that's almost a self-defeating mindset because you're not fully immersing into it. You're not saying that, you know, it's, I will probably be racing triathlons for the entirety of my life in my athletic career, running marathons, running half marathons and 10Ks. But to place the importance on one race distance, one specific sport, triathlon, was never the goal. Just to do one was never the goal. If I were to decide that doing one was the goal, then that would be completely different. And I think the same goes for, is the marathon the goal? Or is to enjoy running the goal? Those are two different goals. Like, one is to immerse with a community and like live as a part of quality of life. And the other is to excel at the marathon distance. You know what I'm saying? And I think that's what separates a lot of the folks that were in the collegiate system that become elites and sub-elites in their post-collegiate career. They were the sport. They did the sport in college. It wasn't about quality of life. It was something much deeper than that. It was who they are. You know, it's like a part of the DNA structure. It wasn't like a wanton desire to just be great at the marathon. It was like, no, they signed up to be great. Yeah. You know, it's very interesting to kind of think about. It's super subtle, but
it is interesting to see, you know, I have had 30 plus years of experience coaching athletes that were trying to qualify for Boston.
Sure.
So I've seen the qualification change. I've seen the times get faster. I've seen more people join, more people get excited about it. But the basic vibe and the flavor is pretty much the same for those 30 years. Another thing that's really the same that is really pertinent to what we're discussing right now is once the athlete achieves their goal of Boston, they end up in one of two camps. They end up in the I'm going to Boston forever, or I'm going to do streak it. I'm going to do it 10 years. I'm going to do this. Boston's the thing. They have an experience of Boston that just totally moves them. Like we were talking about last year when we were when we did our post-Boston. That there's this special vibe that Boston provides, and people fall for that. And it's beautiful and it's wonderful. And they get really focused on getting there every year. Although a just perfect example is many of those folks actually get requalified at Boston each year.
If you really want to do it as a practitioner of Boston Marathon, the way to do it is to qualify that year.
But that requires for many people to be right on. That's not something somebody gains right off the bat. So some people, you know, especially, well, for some men and women, for some men and women, they get it right away. But for those who shoot for it for a while, when they get it, they fall into one of two camps. They do Boston forever. And not forever, but they do it for a period. Or no matter how good or bad their Boston experience is, they're like, fuck that, I'm out. I'm out. That doesn't mean they're not going to race anymore, but they're just, and that can happen because it costs so much money. They have too high an expectation of what's going to happen when they get there. They have a really hard, challenging, difficult weather day, or they run into the teeth of the challenges about being in Southern Massachusetts on
Patriots Day and dealing with the varieties of weather conditions that can show up, or they, or you know, something like 2014 really impacted people with the bombing and how that really impacted people. I think 2013, 14, I can't remember exactly which year it was, but it really impacted people. And then people came back for another reason because of that. But I think that they do fall into these two camps pretty consistently. But the people who no longer race Boston don't stop training and racing. They just go to Boston once every 3 or 4 years as they recognize a friend group wants to go, or there's a vibe in their crew that that's where people want to go. And then they deselect for extended windows of time, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, where they don't think about Boston. It's so interesting. And I think that that's similar with the Ironman bug, is that trying to get to Kona, which has changed appreciably over those 30 years. Like, the getting to Boston is not that much different for the everyday person. However, getting to Kona has significantly changed for the everyday person.
There's also a lot going on there, you know, in terms of
the politics of the sport.
Yeah. The politics of the sport. Boston is undeniably
for the everyman.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it is it is a welcomed, and it is a, it's a, I mean, the whole place lights up.
It's not elitist.
Right.
It's not elitist.
And, you know, it's, I don't know anything about the race in Kona, but I do know that it's not necessarily welcomed. It shuts down the entire island. Like, there's some things that surround it. And then when you mix the politics in there, it was a little bit, I think one of the reasons that I started to decouple from Kona was Boston. And it's like, because that was such a great experience that I don't even know if I want to go race in a place where the local community doesn't exactly say, this is exactly what we stand for, this is what we want every year. And then the organization running it is like, no, let's game it, let's do all this stuff. I'm like, I don't know if I want that to be in that kind of mindset.
I'm really
kind of holding back kind of my suspicion in the entity of kind of the sport. And I don't really know. Like, I just don't know. It's changed so much. Now, like, women are racing in France and men are racing in Kona, and then every year it switches now. It's like it's very odd. And it's like the slot system is weird. It's not a time system. It's like how many slots you have. And if it just, there's something,
it's
so
changed.
It's just changed. Yeah.
You know, another event that's getting, is on the cusp of having similar problems is New York City Marathon.
Really?
Well, it will never happen because the city of New York straight up, flat out loves that event.
Okay.
So you don't have that sort of infrastructure overwhelm. You know, like, people who live locally in Austin, South By used to be just out of control. Now Austin's big enough that I didn't even notice South By this year. I didn't. And you live in the
so
middle
weird.
Of it. And you did, but it used to be people were really upset about South By because they couldn't go to their favorite restaurants. They couldn't go to their favorite bars. They had, you know, things, their bars were co-opted by the schedule. So, you know, anyway, but New York City just loves the event. They absolutely put their arms around the event. But the race directors and the organization that's running it, New York Roadrunners, they have now created more and more wrinkles to the qualification process. And they're getting into a space of over gaming it and playing a game that's going to have negative impact and negative connotations. Early on, after in the next 3 to 5 years, it'll probably get more and more competitive and more exciting, and more people want to go. But that will wane, because
Boston's already ambiguous enough.
Correct.
If you game it further than that,
correct,
it's really hard to do that first conversation.
It's so privileging the New York Roadrunner with the ability to run these races and get these seven. So,
and I think if you, like, volunteer at some,
there's all these weird
events.
Things.
It's like you don't have to be in the state. You can just go there and volunteer. And
I mean, you also have all of the charity stuff, but that's always been going on. And, you know, to me, the charity stuff, I deeply appreciate the ability for these events to raise money for charity, but they need,
I've been making this argument with Boston all the time. Tell us exactly how many fucking people are on the starting line for a charity and make sure the money, a lot of money goes to the charity. Don't make it easy. Make it really fucking hard.
Yeah.
Make it $10,000 you have to raise so that people, you'll still make the same amount of money. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And give those spots to the people. The problem is it's they're all gaming it. They're playing this game. But I don't want to go down that road too far because
it's
I don't.
It's not necessarily that we're going down that road. It's just when you start to see doing the sport over and over and over and looking forward to these goals, it's like we talked about months ago, which is like, what is a sub three? Like, it, what is it at all? Like, we just push for these goals, and once you get them, it's kind of like, oh, you're standing in a parking lot where it's just like, oh, I got
But we can't deny that there's some energetic, the word I will use is egregore, which is this weird word that's now coming around about sort of the spirit of a thing, how a thing has a vibe and an energy. There's no doubt. I've been coaching athletes for 30 years in the marathon. 3 hours is a serious threshold, and there's no good reason for it. There's no good reason for it. I mean, it is 7 minute, but you have to go under 7 minute pace, right? Yeah. That's a real threshold.
Yeah.
You see that again at 2:40. You see that again at sub 2:40 when you have to get to the 6 minute, you know, stat 2:35, 2:40. But that sits in this middle ground. But there's something about that averaging sub 7 minute mile pace for 26.2 miles, and the number three has this real concerted energy that makes it a real threshold that's challenging. And so there are these thresholds like that exist.
But if it changes the way you feel about the sport that you do every day, that's the only thing I'm trying to call out, which is you can either let that goal, like Kona or Sub 3 or Boston or New York, dictate how you feel about your daily practice, or you can just focus on your daily practice with those goals in mind, and maybe it just doesn't feel as owed. Like, it doesn't feel like it has to pay you something. It feels like if you ever get there, it's a sense of kind of wonder and gratitude and very cool.
But that's, like, not the American way, man.
Yeah, I reckon so.
This is why our desire to steal the culture is not being printed on shirts and everybody raising their arms in gratitude and thanks.
Like, I'm genuinely, yeah, I suppose.
It is.
Because all of what I've been doing is an effort to get to Kona. So, like, you see what I'm saying? Like,
but now you're recognizing, because you've so honored the practice of being an athlete and the honored being an athlete and all the privileges inherent in that, having the financial wherewithal to be able to invest that amount of time in training for a marathon. You're cognizant of those things and you're aware of those things. They may not be front of mind.
And it's more of a deep, profound respect for the people that do get there.
Yes.
And that spend their time doing it.
Yes.
And I don't want to necessarily think anymore that I need to cut in line to go take somebody else's spot on for a transplant and, you know, the Kona machine. Like, yeah. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, it's a mindset where I thought I was the person that deserved it, but it's like, well, are you? Are you really the person that deserves it? Are you really the person that needs to go to Boston? And I think that is a very deep question. Do you just want to go to Boston, or do you really, are you the kind of person that breathes it?
And if you do breathe it and you do, and you take the time, it'll happen.
I think that it'll happen.
Right.
That's the weird part about it, is you kind of, if you couple that with some realism and time and not being too rigid, and you kind of lose a little bit of the control and you start to submit, then it's like, then the process will unfold. You know, in the back of my head, it's like, if I end up racing in Hawaii when I'm 50, like, that's cool, but it will be because there is a continuum that is,
and
a
that
part
hook,
of who I,
and that hook might get put right in your, you might just get hooked by time and circumstances and the decision and where you are in your life to really go for it. But right now, the balance of life, it doesn't match.
Exactly.
Because
so there's
not
a race
willing.
Coming up that's not that race.
Right.
There's a marathon that people have to qualify before Boston.
They have to use
it.
So
we're thinking about Boston at another race. It's the weirdest thing. We're thinking about other races while we're racing the race that we sign up for. And it's one of those things, like if you love something, let it go. You know, just, it's a stupid cliche, but if you really love a thought, then let it go and just be present in the thing that you have right now. You know, it's like kind of...
I was on a run with the Atreyu Run Club this morning and yesterday, mm-hmm. and the guy I was running with, I mentioned to him, he started his own little run club in a local neighborhood, and he said something, and I'm like, he's like, well, we started, didn't have any people, but now we've got like a good number of people. I'm like, you know, Field of Dreams? If you build it, they will come.
Yeah.
But there's a catch to if you build it, will they come? You have to build something you really believe in. You can't just, it's not like, oh, I just created a little field in the middle of the of a cornfield. I made a baseball field in the middle of a cornfield and shit happened. It was because Kevin Costner's character was so invested with his intention.
Yeah.
That the kind of magic that was necessary for that kind of magical situation to occur needed that kind of energetic input, and that's what the point you're making.
Yeah.
You need to have the energetic intention, the intention that is so backed with energy of desire, of sacrifice, of commitment, of recognition of what it takes to get there, and not some sort of, oh, I'm owed it because I want it.
And I would tell you, if this is a cop-out, saying I'm just tired and I don't want to go for it, it's not
that.
No,
you would.
And because it's 100% not that. And I think that, you know, it's, I'm finding that there's a way to do this. Same thing with work. Same thing with Atreyu. The Kona equivalent for Atreyu would be like a, you know, massive shoe company, like maybe 1% of the running industry, and a big old building with a fancy sign on it, and like, you know, people, and
like FloTrack has here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It'd be like, that would be the equivalent of the Kona. And I was like, you know what? It's just not. Even with work, I've revamped it. And I was like, the only thing that work should do for me right now is to allow me to live in this city and to do what I do. That's it. And so just engineer it to be where you are and where you want it to be. You know, where you are might not be where you want it to be, but those two are closely linked than where you hope that it will be in the future. One of them is more tangible. One of them is more like, this is what my grandpa said. You know, he's coming to the end of his life, and, you know, he's been pretty eccentric, pretty successful dude, but he said, never build a business to sell it. Always build a business to pay you first. Make sure it pays you first. That's it. Most people shoot way beyond that and never even get to the pay you first part. But they're trying to go from a 2 to a 10, and they're not trying to get to a 3 or a 4. And they need to be to like a 3 or a 4 or a 5 just to kind of like keep it going, just keep it going. And then if the business were to ever throw off 6, 7, 8 status, you know, then shoot, sky's the limit. But don't even think about that until, just build something to pay you. Build your training program to pay you. What is that currency that you want to get paid in? That's quality of life, that's fitness, that's goal times, that's experience, that's longevity, it's like all the stuff. And then if you get there, you might just be able to go past that. You know, you might be able to even go further. You know, maybe for those running like a 3:30 marathon and they dream about a 3, it's just like, if paying you is what you want to run every day, it's like, you know, 7:30s on your runs, and it's just like, get there, just get there. Like, go for it. Go run a string of 3:10s and just make that your home. And then one day, like, if you're ever feeling it, then go for it. It's just like, why we always try and jump from a 2 to a 10. And I find that there's a lot of essence in just kind of honing in, and across the board with work, with training, with trying to enjoy myself, I've discovered that this period, 1 month out from a race, I would usually be really like pissy, fucking, you know, negative.
Overtrained, exhausted,
negative. But right now, I'm generally optimistic. My order for the shoes are late again. And for the first time, I'm not on the phone trying to call the trucking company, the port, you know, talking to everybody, trying to figure something out. It's just out of my hands. Mm-hmm. It's just out of the hands. Should be happy. You know, it is what it is. Totally different mindset. But I think that mindset is the same mindset that decouples you from the kind of delusion that we're owed something, you know, instead of just being where we are.
Yeah. I just got the idea, too, that I think I want to highlight something just in the last bit of this discussion around something you mentioned when you were talking about how your grandfather said, hey, your work, no, more along the lines of what you want this job to be for you, what Atreyu is, which is to allow you to live in this city and be effective and have a job. But I do think there's another piece that those of us who are entrepreneurs have that I also think relates to running, you know, these ideas of running that we're using as sort of cross, we're kind of walking between the two of them.
It's all the same.
It is this idea of creativity that's afforded to those who need creativity. And not everybody needs it in their work and not everybody needs it in their running. But once you know you need it, once you catch the creativity bug from a business perspective, like I'm ruined for business.
Yeah.
Because I don't have the ability to be creative. I will never be able to be as creative in another environment as I can be in this. You will never have another opportunity to go work for another shoe company. You will never be able to be as creative as you can be now. And that checks a number of different boxes. That can be from a design element, from a organizational element, from a lifestyle creativity to, you know, there's a whole bunch of different places that that can be. But in running, I think this is another really critical, crucial part that once you catch the creativity bug with running, you start playing with it, you realize, oh, you're ruined for racing. You're ruined for those kinds of bullshit, like non-real goals. Those goals are, they become really arbitrary because you're recognizing I'm looking for creativity in my training experience. I'm looking for the creativity that comes from being a runner generally. I'm looking forward to the creativity of that particular race on that given day. I'm looking forward to the creativity of challenging myself to 3 or 4 different races over the cycle of a period of a cycle. Whatever the case may be, there's this element of creativity that is, once it's in play, this is a huge part of what it means to be human. Like,
right.
We have mammals play. Mm-hmm. All mammals play. Mm-hmm. It is critical to our functionality. And when you're running or your workspace is not about that, it's about checking boxes and punching holes, and it gets really mechanistic or industrialized or whatever. You lose the creativity, you lose meaning, purpose, vibe, energy, motivation, you lose everything.
And that's the essence, which is, it's the same goal, but understanding that it's not just, it's an open-ended goal, not so much a myopic goal.
And it allows for that creativity. Uncertainty is in play.
Yes.
And when you were organizing your thinking around getting a Kona qualifier, you were trying to minimize as much uncertainty. You're trying to minimize uncertainty as much as possible.
But it wasn't creative. It felt very mechanical.
It has to.
Right?
And then you sense the overtraining because it's being dictated from above. Somebody's telling you what to do rather than you just being like, and who tells us what to do? Culture? Like, ultimately, that's what it is in running.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure about Ironman or triathlon culture, but for sure in running, it's that the culture tells people they have to do this.
Yeah.
And until that change, until someone has that experience of creativity and they feel that beautiful race, they have a beautiful race, intentional or not. And this happens frequently. I have an athlete who's running Boston coming up, and we were just talking about her last workout. That's coming up this weekend. And I was talking to her, well, if you've got a goal, you want to be thinking about your goal and how to play out with that. But right before she left, she ran New York last year. And I was like, remember though, if you want to have an experience like you had at New York, she just got on the starting line and didn't care what her time was. She didn't run very fast, but she was like, it's one of the top marathons I've ever run in my entire life for the pure pleasure and joy of it. And that's creativity. I did say to her right before she walked off, I was like, remember, you still have the opportunity to have a New York City experience at Boston, but it comes from knowing where you're at.
I would highly encourage that.
Knowing where you're at. Like, yeah. You have to know, are you ready to go sub X, or are you want to play it a little more conservatively and allow the race to play out?
neither one are right or wrong, but is there an element of creativity that's in play here? Or are you being drug around by some clock, some watch, some... Because ultimately, you're going to cross that finish line, and if you succeed, I've said this 100 times if I've said it once, if you cross that finish line and you succeed, you will not enjoy it for more than 3 hours. You'll suddenly be thinking about the next big one and how much faster you're going to run at the next one. And if you don't succeed, you're going to feel completely like a heel and feel like shit.
And that's the biggest... That's the biggest tragedy of everything, because you're literally in a place.
They're both tragedies.
The one where you, yeah, but think about like the fact that when do you go to a party and then it's like, and if you party too hard and fall asleep before everybody goes home, it's just like, well, I'm going to be real pissed off about that. And it's like, you're literally...
Watch out for your
this
pregame.
Is, this
Watch
is
out
such
for the pregame.
A, yeah, it's so interesting to think, like, I don't want to say that there are no bad race experiences, because there definitely can be some very heartbreaking race experience, and I don't want to take that from anybody, because I know that there is some heartbreak in it. That being said, I think that all racing that we choose to do is a luxury and a privilege, yes. And it's a celebration and a party. And if we fail to experience that on race day in any capacity, I think that is a tragedy. It's not a mistake. It's easy to do. I've done it all. I've done it a lot. I've gotten a plane. I've flown across the country. I've done things. I've spent months doing it, all to miss the fact that these things are a celebration of people who are all stoked to be out there. But some people decide that something bad was done to them on race day because they weren't good enough. And I'm like, that to me is just, I don't see that scenario where that's actually true.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, there's something so deep about that one.
This reminds me of a highly recommended and very pertinent for our listeners. Those of you who like to listen to podcasts, if you're listening to this, you like to listen to podcasts. I took a gamble and listened to Kara Goucher's podcast with Rich Roll recently.
Oh, yeah. I've saw it. I'm going to put it on this weekend on the bike.
Thinking that I've not been a big fan of Kara's. There's parts of her, I don't know Kara as personally at all, but I just didn't like something about her all along throughout her career. But after listening to this episode, I have a deeper, way deeper appreciation. And I have I have to take back, I've recently talked about how Alberto Salazar, his actions around doping have always been indeterminate, but you hear her story and it's really hard to think that they were anything other than what they are. But that's not really the sad part of it. The thing I wanted to bring people's attention to is all these things, and Kara also has a terrible autoimmune disease right now that's really impacting her ability to run. She can't really run more than 3 or 4 miles at a given time. But when you finish this episode, if you don't have a deeper appreciation for the beauty of running itself and how running is a path with heart, because Kara, I'm a huge fan of hers. I've liked her commentating, because I think she just brings fire and energy and excitement and passion. But I didn't realize how deep it was for the sport and how she's coming at it as a path with heart. And for any of you listeners who have or are curious about her story, even if you've read her book, she shares other things that are outside of what's in that book. It was another situation where I said, oh my God, don't judge it. I was judging a book by its cover, and her story is just really compelling. But at the end of the day, the story is about creativity. The story is about what this sport can offer and provide. And her basic statement is, I just want people to run, and I want everybody to have a running experience, no matter how terrible and horrible my
running
experience is.
That's the topic
is.
I want to...
It's that, beautiful.
That I love that.
Plus, you'll love the episode. It's
plus,
really,
I don't
really
know
good.
As much about Kara Goucher as I, you know... I don't
Going
know.
Back to
it was
the 10K,
a bit,
she's,
yeah,
she's
it was,
a world
again,
champion.
Again, that was
she's
track
a,
and field. That's yeah. like out of my game.
Yeah, she was a 10K. She was a medalist at the World Championships.
But anybody who hangs out with Des Linden, in my personal opinion,
has to be cool.
Has to be a genuine and cool human yes. being, because Des and told me the coolest thing that's ever anybody's ever said.
What'd she say?
It was at the running event, and she was she was like, my buddy Brian Metzler was like, hey, let's go. Let me go introduce you. It's Deslin. And I was like, all right, cool. So I walked up and she goes, oh yeah, Atreyu. Like, yeah, I've been rooting you guys on since the beginning. Y'all are, you know, just, and I was like, oh, you, what? That's, yeah, that's weird. And she goes, how's everything going? And I go, you know, it's like, I said something kind of like self-deprecating. I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing. It's like a car and the wheels are falling. And she goes, you know exactly what you're doing, you know, and she stopped me right there and she was like, no, you've done an exceptional job. You know exactly what you're doing. It's tough, but you're going to get there. And it was like the most warrior thing that anybody's ever said. I'm like, oh shoot. She like breathes champion shit. Yeah, like, she, like does. She is the ultimate positive mindset. And I don't know. I'll never forget that. I was like, that, no room for self-deprecation. And it kind of challenged me because I'm very, used to be a very self-deprecating person. And yeah, like, even to this day, but yeah, like the, as a duo, it'll be, I'm going to watch that podcast
and Rich,
on the bike.
And Rich doesn't get in the way. So Rich does a good job. He can sometimes get in the way, but he doesn't get in the way. It's really well done. And I really enjoyed it and I highly recommend it to listeners. It's a long episode, but it's good. It's worth a listen. And their podcast is really worth a listen too. It's a little more, you know, it's definitely for the more experienced runner who's looking for the kinds of information around what's going on in the industry, what's happening in racing and those kinds of things. But it's really good too. Anyway, I just wanted to say that.
Yeah. And I agree with her point is that I think that everybody needs a good experience with running. I mean, there are so many people out there. There are more runners running in the U.S. than there are people racing.
Mm-hmm,
so
for sure.
It's, if you really break it down, I would say it's probably 80% of the runners are running just because they think they need to run, and it's not necessarily tapping into the I run with a run club, I sign up for a 10K every year. Kind of like those are, there's like about 20 million of those folks and under, and then there's like 50 million or, you know, an extra 30 million runners that are just out there. And then I think that my hypothesis is that if a majority of those 30 million folks who run for physical fitness could tap into what running is as a culture, like, it would just be a landslide.
Yeah.
Like, if you want running culture to change, I think the way to do it is to bring new runners in and tap into what they have to offer. So I really think that we could peel off an episode there on kind of introducing new runners into the kind of diehard runner lifestyle.
Cool. Maybe we'll do that soon. Next week, we're going to hit the 5K. So we took a break from it because it's a lot of work to put together. But we'll be back next week with an episode on the 5K. And just FYI, the World Championship of Cross Country is this weekend.
Oh,
so
shit.
Some of the main players, especially Joshua Cheptegei and Jacob Kiplimo, who are two Ugandans who medaled in the last World Championships, I think they both medaled. I know Cheptegei won.
Weren't
I think
they at
Kiplimo,
this last event?
No, they're going to be at the World Championships, and that race looks to be pretty good, especially between the two of them. So it'd be, that's anybody interested in our 10K episode. If you're looking for results to follow, that would be something you might want to check out and see. And it'll be on the YouTube the day after. I think the race is on Saturday. Should be on Sunday. You should have availability for it. And it's a, cross country is a sport in and of itself, but we'll probably lead with that next week, Michael. So I'll be sending you the link to watch the video of it. And it also helps us talk a little bit about cross, because cross is such a weird thing. So, anyway, thanks listeners for hanging with us. Anything, any last comments?
No, man. Thanks for asking me about my race. Thanks to anybody who wanted to hear about it and my mindset going into it. And I think it's going to be a good one. I'm pretty much locked in my race intention, and it's just to be prepared to have, I really want to go for it. I really want to go for it, but I think my biggest challenge going into this race is not going, I don't have a problem going for it, and I don't have a problem blowing up, and I don't have a problem succeeding. I've never had that problem. I always go all in. I've always had a problem mentally about how I feel about the outcome, and it's been fun to realize that over this, and it's been pretty good on the training too. So,
but you'll get tested.
Yeah,
you know, on race day you're going to get tested because you're going to have this desire to link back in with the result, the outcome being primary, and you'll have to
the blood in the teeth.
You'll have to
guy
figure,
that's
have
in
to
there
it
just waiting to come out. I know.
I don't think you stop being a warrior. I do think this is important. People sometimes think a beautiful race means you can't like be a warrior anymore. And I'm like, no, it actually requires you to be a better warrior, because the vision that you have when you're going for outcome is that the only way to be a warrior is to win. But people need to realize in battles, there's winners and there's losers. Half of the parties are disappointed. In the distance running, most of the parties are disappointed. Yeah. So if you're going into it with just for the win, that does that mean that the other people are not warriors? The people who fail aren't warriors? It's like being a good warrior is one who takes failure and success and sees them in the same way.
That's it, man. So it's going to be good. Like I'm actually getting excited. So getting real excited. I think this conversation actually is the first time I've tapped into that feeling where I'm like imagining what it's going to feel like on race day. And I'm like, oh shit.
It's good.
It's good.
It's good really to do it this far out. It's good to do it this far out. It can be nerve-wracking for some people because of performances who are so focused on outcome. That's why I don't like to talk about race plan before 2 weeks before for many people. But for you, that's why I was like, no, you want to talk about it earlier because you want to start leaning into that energy. And that energy will disperse and go. You'll find little problems that you need to get the answers to before the gun goes off so that you're ready to be more open and available and stay in an open space. So,
well, I appreciate that. It'll be fun to recap it when it's done.
Yep. Well, thanks, listeners. Godspeed. We'll talk to you next week.